An old friend stopped by last week on his way from California to Kentucky, and as we reminisced about the years we have known each other, he said, "Tell me something you have learned that you think is important." I was not surprised to hear myself say this first. "I'm amazed and distressed more than I ever imagined I would be by what we do to children." I suppose there have been more than the usual opportunities for me to know. Over the years, my university students, in their creative writing assignments, have confided the most intimate traumas, things not so likely to be revealed in science or history classes. And Billy has shared stories from her teaching about careless parents, unhappy and spiteful teachers, broken homes, until we both have come to think of childhood for many children as a battlefield from which they emerge psychologically maimed and crippled. Some of the wounds never quite heal, so that all around us, every day, there are grown-ups who are permanently insecure, lonely, afraid to love, afraid to be vulnerable, never quite confident that life can be embraced with laughter and with hope. Now, I should tell you, before I get any further into these remarks, that I am not mawkishly sentimental about children. I believe in discipline and expectations. I know that children are not always sweet little M&Ms dropped from heaven. And I understand the man who said, "Children are a great comfort in your old age, and they help you get there quicker." My oldest son, Robin, who is a minister in a congregational church in Oklahoma City, and who will exchange pulpits with me this fall, thinks there may be a kind of cosmic justice in parent-child cycles. A Jewish rabbi, who was his close friend in Detroit, told him that, like other Jewish fathers, he sometimes felt the need to put a pair of loving but admonitory hands on his naughty boy's shoulder and say to him, "May you have a son just like you." Robin and I now have the closest possible personal and professional relationship. But I rejoiced mightily, and so did he, when he moved out to his own apartment during the college years. And when he looks now at his own son, who will be up here with him, I think the cosmic justice thing may occur to him again. Blue is bright and sensitive and delightful in a multitude of ways. He's also the kid someone had in mind who said, "The modern child will answer you back before you've said anything." I watched them in some of their verbal sparring, and I think this child is going to be a brilliant courtroom lawyer. He argues every case with his father with courtroom language and skills. He says things like, "You may have forgotten this, Dad, but I remember very clearly the agreement we had last week." "Dad, please forgive me, but I feel you are being inconsistent on this point." Reasoning with Blue, Robin says, is fine if you can reach his reason without destroying yours. And sometimes watching the two of them reenact still another parent-child history, a line I read somewhere pops into my head. The secret of dealing successfully with a child is not to be its parent. I've said these things so that when I say to you what comes next, you will not dismiss it on the grounds that my head is just full of sentimental mush. I know what children can do to their parents. But I am totally convinced that millions of children are far more sinned against than sinning. And I am not even thinking right now of the future that we are stealing from them by the greedy and thoughtless plundering of their home planet. I believe the UN Declaration, mankind owes to the child the best it has to give. And I believe James Agee, one of my favorite American writers, in every child who is born, under no matter what circumstances, and of no matter what parents, the potentiality of the human race is born again. So I am going to do now what Jesus of Nazareth did so often, tell you a couple of parables drawn from real life, very recent real life. If you have ears to hear, you will hear the gospel in each one. If you have eyes to see, you will see at the end of each story the pained and puzzled face of the man who said, "Let the children come to me. The kingdom of heaven belongs to those who are like them." The first story is a published essay entitled "A Mom's Plea to a Ball Player." It would insult your intelligence to interpret it or to speak a postscript at the end. I will read it without stopping. But as I do, please keep in mind anthropologist Margaret Mead's remark that we must have a place where children can have a whole group of adults they can trust. Here is a mother's story about a little boy and his hero in the age of big money. Baseball is our little boy's passion. And Greg Jeffries, the rookie second baseman for the Mets, is his first and beloved hero. A photograph plaque of Greg Jeffries hangs in a position of honor alone on the wall over his bed. On his 7th birthday, my son solemnly placed a Greg Jeffries baseball card in the center of his birthday cake. So when we heard that Mr. Jeffries would be signing autographs in a toy shop in New Jersey, it was not a question of would we go, but of when. However, as we investigated, we realized that Mr. Jeffries would not simply be visiting with kids and signing autographs. No, he would be selling his autograph, which required buying a $10 ticket, advance purchase advised. I called the toy shop to ask if we really needed to buy a ticket in advance. The owner said that 800 had already been sold and they were expecting to sell 2,000. I was stunned. In a toy store way out in New Jersey, I ordered a ticket. "Just one ticket?" the manager asked incredulously. I panicked and bought three. Expectation kept our son in a state of frenzy. The night before the event, he couldn't sleep. He greeted us at dawn in his Mets uniform, ready to go. When we arrived at the toy shop, a police guard and a bouncer stood squarely in front of the door. Hundreds of families were there with many little mini-mets in uniforms just like our son. The toy shop had taken over the adjacent vacant store for the day and was selling Greg Jeffries' photographs, baseball cards, and other items too fast for him to sign. But the autograph line moved quickly, and before we knew it, we were standing in front of Greg Jeffries. He sat with his girlfriend at a table, signing his name as fast as he could. Greg did not look up when he signed our son's picture. He never saw our son's face go white, his eyes pleading to make contact. This was an assembly line operation. 90 seconds after we entered the shop, we stood outside, autographs in hand. As we drove back, our son sat sadly staring at the autographs. Exasperated by his misery, I snapped, "What's wrong? You got to see Greg Jeffries, and you got his autograph. Three autographs." "But Mom, he didn't even look at me." "Well," I said, "the format wasn't right for a visit or eye contact." "Yeah, but Mom, he's my guy. He's my all-time favorite. You don't understand, Mom. He's my hero." My husband and I slumped in our seats. Now we all felt terrible. But what had we expected? I suppose we had hoped to meet a hero, a symbol of possibility for our son, a wholehearted man who excels at playing his part on a team in a game with rules. And more, a man with enough respect for his craft, the game, and his role, not to merchandise his signature. After a bit, our son's mood lifted. "Mom, if there were 2,000 people out there, that means Greg Jeffries made $20,000. And he made it in 3 hours. How does he spend all that money, Mom? Does he help people?" I told him I didn't know. He begged me to find out. Because, he continued, "if I know how much money he needs to make for 3 hours' work, maybe I can save up enough to pay him to come to our house for dinner." "Hold it. We're not paying anybody anything to come to our house for dinner." "But Mom," he said from the back seat, "that's what Greg Jeffries wants. Money." We've had the same conversation many times since that day. My husband and I are saddened and bewildered. We just read that Jose Canseco and Roger Clemens feel no guilt about selling their autographs. They believe the kids are purchasing the autographs for resale at a profit. But the kids we saw in New Jersey that day were just like our son, little Mets, dressed in the cloth of their hero, straining for a glimpse of Greg Jeffries, the man they all hoped to become. I did call the toy shop on behalf of my son. The owner's wife would not disclose the finances, but she offered some advice. "In today's world, it's never good to get too close to your heroes. Better to view them from afar." But I don't want today's world to be like that. And I wish Greg Jeffries would take his signature off the market. One mother's reaction. An older boy came to our house last week, a boy the age of our youngest son, but with a tragic background of family divorce and bitterness, hatred and handicap. And in the intimacy of our living room, knowing how much we liked him, he revealed one of those wounds that never quite heal. His father and stepmother live out of state. I asked if he had seen his dad lately. I haven't seen him in 3 years. I don't even try to call him. I don't think he cares whether I do or not. And then he explained. The last time he had gone to visit his father, there had been a terrible scene. The stepmother resents this boy as the son of the woman she replaced. So she finds his most vulnerable spot and attacks. And it isn't hard to find his vulnerable spot. This is a gentle, easygoing kid who lacks the driving ambition and perhaps the skills to become a doctor or a lawyer or a corporation president. He's conscientious about his job at Coleman, very proud that he has not missed a day of work in such a long time. Lost in a crowd of faces, he makes no splash in the life of this city, but he is self-supporting and able and willing to help his sister and his mother and his grandmother. But he hurts a great deal inside. So we gave him a chance to tell us what happened the last time he saw his father. It seems that just before he left, his stepmother exploded in pent-up anger and frustration and screamed at him, "Go back to Wichita. You'll never amount to anything. Never." Do you think you could top that? For long-lasting cruelty. She could have said, "You're the clumsiest kid I ever saw and I hate your face," but he isn't clumsy and he is good-looking. So she hit him where he had the thinnest defense. "You'll never amount to anything." We could tell watching him how that had stuck in his soul, the poison seeping a little every single day of his life. First, the incomprehensible hatred of someone who might at least pretend to care about him, and then the self-doubt that grows in the soil of words like hers. We talked of other things for a few minutes, and then he proved that he could not forget any day of his life what she'd said to him. We thought that what he said to us was one of the most heartbreaking things we'd ever heard. It may not affect you as much as it did us, looking at his handsome face and his youth and his pain. You see, he had done what we all have to do. He had found a way, slight as it might be, to salvage some pride. He said, "You know, it won't be long before I'll complete 10 years at Coleman. And I can choose my seniority gift, a Coleman custom wall clock. And I think I'll wrap it up and mail it to her." The proof that she was wrong, that he had amounted to something. So endeth the parables of this morning, meant to be spoken in the name and spirit of him who said tender things about our children. Amen.